Neuromancer by William Gibson. Continued. Cassette 6, Side 1. All he felt now was fear, a generalized dread. He pushed it away, forcing himself to replay Armitage's lecture on the spindle and Villa Straylight. He started climbing. Freeside's ecosystem was limited, not closed. Zion was a closed system, capable of cycling for years without the introduction of external materials. Freeside produced its own air and water, but relied on constant shipments of food, on the regular augmentation of soil nutrients. The Villa Straylight produced nothing at all. "Mon," Malcolm said quietly. "Get up here, side me." Case edged sideways on the circular ladder and climbed the last few rungs. The gangway ended in a smooth, slightly convex hatch, 2 meters in diameter. The hydraulic members of the tube vanished into flexible housings set into the frame of the hatch. "So what do we..." Case's mouth shut as the hatch swung up, a slight differential in pressure puffing fine grit into his eyes. Malcolm scrambled up over the edge, and Case heard the tiny click of the Remington's safety being released. "You the man in the hurry," Malcolm whispered, crouching there. Then Case was beside him. The hatch was centered in a round, vaulted chamber floored with blue non-slip plastic tiles. Malcolm nudged him, pointed, and he saw a monitor set into a curved wall. On the screen, a tall young man with the Tessier Ashpool features was brushing something from the sleeves of his dark suit coat. He stood beside an identical hatch in an identical chamber. "Very sorry, sir," said a voice from a grid centered above the hatch. Case glanced up. "Expected you later, at the axial dock. 1 moment, please." On the monitor, the young man tossed his head impatiently. Malcolm spun as a door slid open to their left, the shotgun ready. A small Eurasian in orange coveralls stepped through and goggled at them. He opened his mouth, but nothing came out. He closed his mouth. Case glanced at the monitor. Blank. "Who?" the man managed. "The Rastafarian Navy," Case said, standing up, the cyberspace deck banging against his hip. "And all we want's a jack into your custodial system." The man swallowed. "Is this a test? It's a loyalty check. It must be a loyalty check." He wiped the palms of his hands on the thighs of his orange suit. "No, man, this a real one." Malcolm came up out of his crouch with the Remington pointed at the Eurasian's face. "You move it." They followed the man back through the door into a corridor whose polished concrete walls and irregular floor of overlapping carpets were perfectly familiar to Case. "Pretty rugs," Malcolm said, prodding the man in the back. "Smell like church." They came to another monitor, an antique Sony, this one mounted above a console with a keyboard and a complex array of jack panels. The screen lit as they halted, the fin grinning tensely out at them from what seemed to be the front room of Metro Holographics. "Okay," he said. "Malcolm takes this guy down the corridor to the open locker door, sticks him in there. I'll lock it. Case, you want the 5th socket from the left, top panel. There's adapter plugs in the cabinet under the console. Needs Ono Sendai 20-point into Hitachi 40. As Malcolm nudged his captive along, Case knelt and fumbled through an assortment of plugs, finally coming up with the one he needed. With his deck jacked into the adapter, he paused. "Do you have to look like that, man?" he asked the face on the screen. The fin was erased a line at a time by the image of Lonnie Zone against a wall of peeling Japanese posters. "Anything you want, baby," Zone drawled. "Just hop it for Lonnie." "No," Case said. "Use the fin." As the Zone image vanished, he shoved the Hitachi adapter into its socket and settled the trodes across his forehead. "What kept you?" the flatline asked and laughed. "Told you don't do that," Case said. "Joke, boy," the construct said. "Zero time-lapse for me. Let me see what we got here." The Quang program was green, exactly the shade of the TA ice. Even as Case watched, it grew gradually more opaque, although he could see the black-mirrored shark thing clearly when he looked up. The fracture lines and hallucinations were gone now, and the thing looked real as Marcus Garvey, a wingless antique jet, its smooth skin plated with black chrome. "Right on," the flatline said. "Right," Case said, and flipped. Like that. I'm sorry, 3Jane was saying as she bandaged Molly's head. Our unit says no concussion, no permanent damage to the eye. You didn't know him very well before you came here?
Didn't know him at all, Molly said bleakly. She was on her back on a high bed or padded table. Case couldn't feel the injured leg. The synesthetic effect of the original injection seemed to have worn off. The black ball was gone, but her hands were immobilized by soft straps she couldn't see.
He wants to kill you.
Figures, Molly said, staring up at the rough ceiling past a very bright light.
I don't think I want him to, 3Jane said,
and Molly painfully turned her head to look up into the dark eyes. Don't play with me, she said.
But I think I might like to, 3Jane said,
and bent to kiss her forehead, brushing the hair back with a warm hand. There were smears of blood on her pale jalaba. Where's he gone now? Molly asked.
Another injection, probably, 3Jane said, straightening up.
He was quite impatient for your arrival. I think it might be fun to nurse you back to health, Molly. She smiled, absently wiping a bloody hand down the front of the robe.
Your leg will need to be reset, but we can arrange that.
What about Peter?
Peter.
She gave her head a little shake. A strand of dark hair came loose, fell across her forehead.
Peter has become rather boring. I find drug use in general to be boring.
She giggled.
In others, at any rate. My father was a dedicated abuser, as you must have seen.
Molly tensed.
Don't alarm yourself.
3Jane's fingers brushed the skin above the waistband of the leather jeans.
His suicide was the result of my having manipulated the safety margins of his freeze. I'd never actually met him, you know. I was decanted after he last went down to sleep, but I did know him very well. The Corps know everything. I watched him kill my mother. I'll show you that when you're better. He strangles her in bed.
Why did he kill her? Her unbandaged eye focused on the girl's face.
He couldn't accept the direction she intended for our family. She commissioned the construction of our artificial intelligences. She was quite a visionary. She imagined us in a symbiotic relationship with the AIs, our corporate decisions made for us. Our conscious decisions, I should say. Tessier Ashpool would be immortal, a hive, each of us units of a larger entity. Fascinating. I'll play her tapes for you. Nearly 1,000 hours. But I've never understood her, really, and with her death, her direction was lost. All direction was lost. And we began to burrow into ourselves. Now we seldom come out. I'm the exception there.
You said you were trying to kill the old man? You fiddled his cryogenic programs? 3Jane nodded.
I had help from a ghost.
That was what I thought when I was very young, that there were ghosts in the corporate corps, voices. One of them was what you call Wintermute, which is the Turing code for our Bairn AI, although the entity manipulating you is a sort of sub-program.
One of them? There's more?
One other. But that one hasn't spoken to me in years. It gave up, I think. I suspect that both represent the fruition of certain capacities my mother ordered designed into the original software. But she was an extremely secretive woman when she felt it necessary.
Here.
Are you enjoying yourself?
Leave us alone, Peter.
Playing doctor? Suddenly Molly stared into her own face, the image suspended 10 centimeters from her nose. There were no bandages. The left implant was shattered, a long finger of silvered plastic driven deep in a socket that was an inverted pool of blood.
Hideo, 3Jane said, stroking Molly's stomach. Hurt Peter if he doesn't go away.
Go and swim, Peter. The projection vanished. 7:58:40 in the darkness of the bandaged eye.
He said you knew the code, Peter said. Wintermute needs the code.
Case was suddenly aware of the chub key that lay on its nylon thong against the inner curve of her left breast.
Yes, 3Jane said, withdrawing her hand. I do. I learned it as a child. I think I learned it in a dream, or somewhere in the 1,000 hours of my mother's diaries. But I think that Peter has a point in urging me not to surrender it. There would be Turing to contend with, if I read all this correctly, and ghosts are nothing if not capricious.
Case jacked out.
Strange little customer, huh?
The Finn grinned at Case from the old Sony. Case shrugged. He saw Malcolm coming back along the corridor with the Remington at his side. The Zionite was smiling, his head bobbing to a rhythm Case couldn't hear. A pair of thin yellow leads ran from his ears to a side pocket in his sleeveless jacket.
"Dubmon," Malcolm said.
"You're fucking crazy," Case told him.
"Here okay, mon. Righteous dub."
"Hey, guys," the Finn said. "On your toes. Here comes your transportation. I can't finesse many numbers as smooth as the pick of 8-gene that conned your doorman, but I can get you a ride over to 3-gene's place."
Case was pulling the adapter from its socket when the riderless service cart swiveled into sight, under the graceless concrete arch marking the far end of their corridor. It might have been the one his Africans had ridden, but if it was, they were gone now. Just behind the back of the low padded seat, its tiny manipulators gripping the upholstery, the little brawn was steadily winking its red LED.
"Bus to catch," Case said to Malcolm.
Chapter 20. He'd lost his anger again. He missed it. The little cart was crowded. Malcolm, the Remington across his knees, and Case, deck and construct against his chest. The cart was operating at speeds it hadn't been designed for. It was top-heavy, cornering, and Malcolm had taken to leaning out in the direction of the turns. This presented no problem when the thing took lefts, because Case sat on the right. But in the right turns, the Zionite had to lean across Case and his gear, crushing him against the seat. He had no idea where they were. Everything was familiar, but he couldn't be sure he'd seen any particular stretch before. A curving hallway lined with wooden showcases displayed collections he was certain he'd never seen. The skulls of large birds, coins, masks of beaten silver. The service cart's 6 tires were silent on the layered carpets. There was only the whine of the electric motor and an occasional faint burst of Zion dub from the foam beads in Melk's ears as he lunged past Case to counter a sharp right. The deck and the construct kept pressing the shuriken in his jacket pocket into his hip.
"You got a watch?" he asked Malcolm.
The Zionite shook his locks.
"Time be time."
"Jesus," Case said and closed his eyes. The brawn scuttled over mounded carpets and tapped one of its padded claws against an oversized rectangular door of dark, battered wood. Behind them, the cart sizzled and shot blue sparks from a louvered panel. The sparks struck the carpet beneath the cart, and Case smelled scorched wool.
"This the way, mon?"
Malcolm eyed the door and snapped the shotgun's safety.
"Hey," Case said, more to himself than to Malcolm. "You think I know?"
The brawn rotated its spherical body, and the LED strobed.
"It wants you open door," Malcolm said, nodding.
Case stepped forward and tried the ornate brass knob. There was a brass plate mounted on the door at eye level, so old that the lettering that had once been engraved there had been reduced to a spidery, unreadable code, the name of some long-dead function or functionary, polished into oblivion. He wondered vaguely if Tessier Ashpool had selected each piece of Straylite individually, or if they'd purchased it in bulk from some vast European equivalent of Metro Holographics. The door's hinges creaked plaintively as he edged it open, Malcolm stepping past him with the Remington thrust forward from his hip.
"Books," Malcolm said.
The library, the white steel shelves with their labels.
"I know where we are," Case said.
He looked back at the service cart. A curl of smoke was rising from the carpet.
"So come on," he said.
"Cart!
Cart?"
It remained stationary. The brawn was plucking at the leg of his jeans, nipping at his ankle. He resisted a strong urge to kick it.
"Yeah?"
It ticked its way around the door. He followed it. The monitor in the library was another Sony, as old as the first one. The brawn paused beneath it and executed a sort of jig.
"Wintermute?"
The familiar features filled the screen. The Finn smiled.
"Time to check in, Case," the Finn said, his eyes screwed up against the smoke of a cigarette. "Come on, Jack."
The brawn threw itself against his ankle and began to climb his leg, its manipulators pinching his flesh through the thin black cloth.
"Shit!"
He slapped it aside and it struck the wall. Two of its limbs began to piston repeatedly, uselessly, pumping the air.
"What's wrong with the goddamn thing?"
Burned out, the Finn said. Forget it. No problem. Jack in now. There were four sockets beneath the screen, but only one would accept the Hitachi adapter. He jacked in. Nothing. Gray void. No matrix, no grid, no cyberspace. The deck was gone. His fingers were... And on the far rim of consciousness, a scurrying, a fleeting impression of something rushing toward him, across leagues of black mirror. He tried to scream. There seemed to be a city beyond the curve of beach, but it was far away. He crouched on his haunches on the damp sand, his arms wrapped tight across his knees, and shook. He stayed that way for what seemed a very long time, even after the shaking stopped. The city, if it was a city, was low and gray. At times it was obscured by banks of mist that came rolling in over the lapping surf. At one point, he decided that it wasn't a city at all, but some single building, perhaps a ruin. He had no way of judging its distance. The sand was the shade of tarnished silver that hadn't gone entirely black. The beach was made of sand. The beach was very long. The sand was damp. The bottoms of his jeans were wet from the sand. He held himself and rocked, singing a song without words or tune. The sky was a different silver, Chiba, like the Chiba sky. Tokyo Bay? He turned his head and stared out to sea, longing for the hologram logo of Fuji Electric, for the drone of a helicopter, anything at all. Behind him, a gull cried. He shivered. A wind was rising. Sand stung his cheek. He put his face against his knees and wept, the sound of his sobbing as distant and alien as the cry of the searching gull. Hot urine soaked his jeans, dribbled on the sand, and quickly cooled in the wind off the water. When his tears were gone, his throat ached. Wintermute, he mumbled to his knees. Wintermute. It was growing dark now, and when he shivered, it was with a cold that finally forced him to stand. His knees and elbows ached. His nose was running. He wiped it on the cuff of his jacket, then searched one empty pocket after another. Jesus, he said, shoulders hunched, tucking his fingers beneath his arms for warmth. Jesus! His teeth began to chatter. The tide had left the beach combed with patterns more subtle than any a Tokyo gardener produced. When he'd taken a dozen steps in the direction of the now invisible city, he turned and looked back through the gathering dark. His footprints stretched to the point of his arrival. There were no other marks to disturb the tarnished sand. He estimated that he'd covered at least a kilometer before he noticed the light. He was talking with rats, and it was rats who first pointed it out, an orange-red glow to his right, away from the surf. He knew that rats wasn't there, that the bartender was a figment of his own imagination, not of the thing he was trapped in, but that didn't matter. He'd called the man up for comfort of some kind, but rats had had his own ideas about Case and his predicament.
Really, my artiste, you amaze me. The lengths you will go to in order to accomplish your own destruction. The redundancy of it. In Night City, you had it in the palm of your hand. The speed to eat your sense away. Drink to keep it all so fluid. Linda for a sweeter sorrow. And the street to hold the axe. How far you've come to do it now, and what grotesque props. Playgrounds hung in space. Castles hermetically sealed. The rarest rots of old Europa. Dead men sealed in little boxes. Magic out of China.
Rats laughed, trudging along beside him, his pink manipulator swinging jauntily at his side. In spite of the dark, Case could see the baroque steel that laced the bartender's blackened teeth.
But I suppose that is the way of an artiste, no? You needed this world built for you, this beach, this place, to die.
Case halted, swayed, turned toward the sound of surf and the sting of blown sand.
Yeah, he said. Shit, I guess.
He walked toward the sound.
Artiste, he heard Rats call. The light. You saw a light. Here, this way.
He stopped again, staggered, fell to his knees, in a few millimeters of icy seawater.
Rats? Light? Rats!
But the dark was total now, and there was only the sound of the surf. He struggled to his feet and tried to retrace his steps. Time passed. He walked on. And then it was there,
a glow, defining itself with his every step. A rectangle, a door. "Fire in there," he said, his words torn away by the wind. It was a bunker, stone or concrete, buried in drifts of the dark sand. The doorway was low, narrow, doorless and deep, set into a wall at least a meter thick. "Hey," Kay said softly. "Hey." His fingers brushed the cold wall. There was a fire in there, shifting shadows on the sides of the entrance. He ducked low and was through, inside, in three steps. A girl was crouched beside rusted steel, a sort of fireplace where driftwood burned, the wind sucking smoke up a dented chimney. The fire was the only light, and as his gaze met the wide, startled eyes, he recognized her headband, a rolled scarf, printed with a pattern like magnified circuitry. He refused her arms that night, refused the food she offered him, the place beside her in the nest of blankets, and shredded foam. He crouched beside the door, finally, and watched her sleep, listening to the wind scour the structure's walls. Every hour or so, he rose and crossed to the makeshift stove, adding fresh driftwood from the pile beside it. None of this was real, but cold was cold. She wasn't real, curled there on her side in the firelight. He watched her mouth, the lips parted slightly. She was the girl he remembered from their trip across the bay, and that was cruel. "Mean motherfucker," he whispered to the wind. "Don't take a chance, do you? Wouldn't give me any junkie, huh? I know what this is." He tried to keep the desperation from his voice. "I know, see? I know who you are. You're the other one. Three Jane told Molly. Burning Bush. That wasn't Wintermute, it was you. He tried to warn me off with the brawn. Now you got me flatlined, you got me here. Nowhere. With a ghost. Like I remember her before." She stirred in her sleep, called something out, drawing a scrap of blanket across her shoulder and cheek. "You aren't anything," he said to the sleeping girl. "You're dead, and you meant fuck all to me anyway. Hear that, buddy? I know what you're doing. I'm flatlined. This has all taken about 20 seconds, right? I'm out on my ass in that library, and my brain's dead, and pretty soon it'll be dead if you got any sense. You don't want Wintermute to pull his scam off, is all, so you can just hang me up here. Dixie'll run Quang, but his ass is dead, and you can second-guess his moves, sure. This Linda shit, yeah, that's all been you, hasn't it? Wintermute tried to use her when he sucked me into the Chiba construct, but he couldn't. Said it was too tricky. That was you moved the stars around in Freeside, wasn't it? That was you put her face on the dead puppet in Ashpool's room. Molly never saw that. You just edited her SimStim signal. 'Cause you think you can hurt me. 'Cause you think I gave a shit. Well, fuck you, whatever you're called. You won. You win. But none of it means anything to me now, right? Think I care? So why'd you do it to me this way?" He was shaking again, his voice shrill. "Honey," she said, twisting up from the rags of blankets, "you come here and sleep. I'll sit up, you want. You gotta sleep, okay?" Her soft accent was exaggerated with sleep. "You just sleep, okay?" When he woke, she was gone. The fire was dead, but it was warm in the bunker, sunlight slanting through the doorway to throw a crooked rectangle of gold on the ripped side of a fat fiber canister. The thing was a shipping container. He remembered them from the Chiba docks. Through the rent in its side, he could see half a dozen bright yellow packets. In the sunlight, they looked like giant pats of butter. His stomach tightened with hunger. Rolling out of the nest, he went to the canister and fished one of the things out, blinking at small print in a dozen languages. The English was on the bottom. "Emerge ration, high pro, beef, type AG-8. A listing of nutritive content. He fumbled a second one out. "Eggs." "If you're making this shit up," he said, "you could lay on some real food, okay?" With a packet in either hand, he made his way through the structure's four rooms. Two were empty, aside from drifts of sand, and the fourth held three more of the ration canisters. "Sure," he said, touching the seals. "Stay here a long time. I get the idea. Sure." He searched the room with the fireplace, finding a plastic canister filled with what he assumed was rainwater. Beside the nest of blankets against the wall lay a cheap red lighter, a seaman's knife with a cracked green handle, and her scarf. It was still knotted and stiff with sweat and dirt. He used the knife to open the yellow packets, dumping their contents into a rusted can that he found beside the stove. He dipped water from the canister, mixed the resulting mush with his fingers, and ate. It tasted vaguely like beef. When it was gone, he tossed the can into the fireplace and went out. Late afternoon by the feel of the sun, its angle. He kicked off his damp nylon shoes and was startled by the warmth of the sand. In daylight, the beach was silver gray. The sky was cloudless, blue. He rounded the corner of the bunker and walked toward the surf, dropping his jacket on the sand. "Don't know whose memories you're using for this one," he said when he reached the water. He peeled off his jeans and kicked them into the shallow surf, following them with T-shirt and underwear.
"What you doing, Case?"
He turned and found her 10 meters down the beach, the white foam sliding past her ankles. "I pissed myself last night," he said.
"Well, you don't want to wear those. Salt water. Give you sores. I'll show you this pool back in the rocks."
She gestured vaguely behind her. "It's fresh." The faded French fatigues had been hacked away above the knee. The skin below was smooth and brown. A breeze caught at her hair. "Listen," he said, scooping his clothes up and walking toward her. "I got a question for you. I won't ask you what you're doing here, but what exactly do you think I'm doing here?" He stopped, a wet black jeans leg slapping against his bare thigh.
"You came last night," she said.
She smiled at him.
"And that's enough for you? I just came?"
"He said you would," she said, wrinkling her nose. She shrugged.
"He knows stuff like that, I guess."
She lifted her left foot and rubbed salt from the other ankle, awkward, childlike. She smiled at him again, more tentatively.
"Now you answer me one, okay?"
He nodded.
"How come you're painted brown like that, all except your foot?"
"And that's the last thing you remember?" He watched her scrape the last of the freeze-dried hash from the rectangular steel box cover that was their only plate. She nodded, her eyes huge in the firelight.
"I'm sorry, Case, honest to God. It was just the shit, I guess, and it was..."
She hunched forward, forearms across her knees, her face twisted for a few seconds with pain or its memory.
"I just needed the money. To get home, I guess, or hell," she said. "You wouldn't hardly talk to me."
"There's no cigarettes?"
"God damn, Case. You asked me that 10 times today. What's wrong with you?"
She twisted a strand of her hair into her mouth and chewed at it. "But the food was here. It was already here?"
"I told you, man. It was washed up on the damn beach."
"Okay, sure. It's seamless." She started to cry again, a dry sobbing.
"Well, damn you anyway, Case," she managed finally. "I was doing just fine here by myself."
He got up, taking his jacket, and ducked through the doorway, scraping his wrist on rough concrete. There was no moon, no wind, sea sound all around him in the darkness. His jeans were tight and clammy.
"Okay," he said to the night. "I buy it. I guess I buy it. But tomorrow some cigarettes better wash up."
His own laughter startled him. "A case of beer wouldn't hurt while you're at it." He turned and re-entered the bunker. She was stirring the embers with a length of silvered wood.
"Who was that, Case? Up in your coffin in cheap hotel. Flash samurai with those silver shades, black leather. Scared me, and after, I figured maybe she was your new girl, except she looked like more money than you had."
She glanced back at him.
"I'm real sorry I stole your ram."
"Never mind," he said. "Doesn't mean anything. So you just took it over to this guy and had him access it for you?"
"Tony," she said. "I'd been seeing him, kinda. He had a habit, and we... Anyway, yeah. I remember him running it by on this monitor, and it was this real amazing graphics stuff. And I remember wondering how you..."
"There wasn't any graphics in there," he interrupted.
"Sure was. I just couldn't figure out how you'd have all those pictures of when I was little, Case. How my daddy looked before he left. Give me this duck one time, painted wood, and you had a picture of that."
"Tony see it?"
"I don't remember. Next thing, I was on the beach real early, sunrise, those birds all yelling so lonely. Scared, 'cause I didn't have a shot on me, nothing, and I knew I'd be getting sick. And I walked and walked till it was dark and found this place." And next day the food washed in, all tangled in the green sea stuff like leaves of hard jelly. She slid her stick into the embers and left it there. Never did get sick, she said, as embers crawled. Missed cigarettes more. How about you, Case? You still wired?
Firelight dancing under her cheekbones, remembered flash of Wizard's Castle and Tank War Europa.
No, he said. And then it no longer mattered what he knew, tasting the salt of her mouth where tears had dried. There was a strength that ran in her, something he'd known in Night City and held there, been held by it, held for a while away from time and death, from the relentless street that hunted them all. It was a place he'd known before. Not everyone could take him there, and somehow he always managed to forget it. Something he'd found and lost so many times. It belonged, he knew, he remembered, as she pulled him down, to the meat, the flesh the cowboys mocked. It was a vast thing, beyond knowing, a sea of information coded in spiral and pheromone, infinite intricacy that only the body, in its strong, blind way, could ever read. The zipper hung, caught, as he opened the French fatigues, the coils of toothed nylon clotted with salt. He broke it, some tiny metal part shooting off against the wall as salt-rotten cloth gave, and then he was in her, effecting the transmission of the old message. Here, even here, in a place he knew for what it was, a coded model of some stranger's memory, the drive held. She shuddered against him as the stick caught fire, a leaping flare that threw their locked shadows across the bunker wall. Later, as they lay together, his hand between her thighs, he remembered her on the beach, the white foam pulling at her ankles, and he remembered what she had said. "He told you I was coming," he said. But she only rolled against him, buttocks against his thighs, and put her hand over his, and muttered something out of a dream. Chapter 21. The music woke him, and at first it might have been the beat of his own heart. He sat up beside her, pulling his jacket over his shoulders in the pre-dawn chill, gray light from the doorway and the fire long dead. His vision crawled with ghost hieroglyphs, translucent lines of symbols arranging themselves against the neutral backdrop of the bunker wall. He looked at the backs of his hands, saw faint neon molecules crawling beneath the skin, ordered by the unknowable code. He raised his right hand and moved it experimentally. It left a faint, fading trail of strobed afterimages. The hair stood up along his arms and at the back of his neck. He crouched there with his teeth bared and felt for the music. The pulse faded, returned, faded. "What's wrong?" She sat up, clawing hair from her eyes. "Baby, I feel like a drug. You get that here?" She shook her head, reached for him, her hands on his upper arms. "Linda, who told you? Who told you I'd come? Who?" "On the beach," she said, something forcing her to look away. "A boy. I see him on the beach, maybe 13. He lives here." "And what did he say?" "He said you'd come. He said you wouldn't hate me. He said we'd be okay here, and he told me where the rain pool was. He looks Mexican." "Brazilian," Case said, as a new wave of symbols washed down the wall. "I think he's from Rio." He got to his feet and began to struggle into his jeans. "Case," she said, her voice shaking. "Case, where you going?" "I think I'll find that boy," he said, as the music came surging back, still only a beat, steady and familiar, although he couldn't place it in memory. "Don't, Case." "I thought I saw something when I got here, a city down the beach, but yesterday it wasn't there. You ever seen that?" He yanked his zipper up and tore at the impossible knot in his shoelaces, finally tossing the shoes into the corner. She nodded, eyes lowered. "Yeah, I see it sometimes." "You ever go there, Linda?" He put his jacket on. "No," she said, "but I tried. After I first came and I was bored. Anyway, I figured it's a city. Maybe I could find some shit." She grimaced. "I wasn't even sick. I just wanted it. So I took food in a can, mixed it real wet because I didn't have another can for water, and I walked all day, and I could see it sometimes, city, and it didn't seem too far. But it never got any closer. And then it was getting closer, and I saw what it was. Sometimes that day it had looked kind of like it was wrecked,
or maybe nobody there. And other times, I thought I'd see light flashing off a machine. Cars or... Her voice trailed off. What is it? This thing, she gestured around the fireplace, the dark walls, the dawn outlining the doorway. Where we live. It gets smaller, Case. Smaller, closer you get to it. Pausing one last time by the doorway. You ask your boy about that? Yeah. He said I wouldn't understand, and I was wasting my time. Said it was like an event, and it was our horizon. Event horizon, he called it. The words meant nothing to him. He left the bunker and struck out blindly, heading, he knew somehow, away from the sea. Now the hieroglyphs sped across the sand, fled from his feet, drew back from him as he walked. Hey, he said, it's breaking down. Bet you know, too. What is it, Quang? Chinese icebreaker eating a hole in your heart? Maybe the Dixie Flatline's no pushover, huh? He heard her call his name, looked back, and she was following him, not trying to catch up, the broken zip of the French fatigues flapping against the brown of her belly, pubic hair framed in torn fabric. She looked like one of the girls on the Finn's old magazines in Metro holographics come to life, only she was tired and sad and human, the ripped costume pathetic as she stumbled over clumps of salt-silver seagrass. And then, somehow, they stood in the surf, the three of them, and the boy's gums were wide and bright pink against his thin brown face. He wore ragged, colorless shorts, limbs too thin against the sliding blue-gray of the tide. I know you, Case said, Linda beside him. No, the boy said, his voice high and musical. You do not. You're the other AI. You're Rio. You're the one who wants to stop Wintermute. What's your name? Your Turing code. What is it? The boy did a handstand in the surf, laughing. He walked on his hands, then flipped out of the water. His eyes were Riviera's, but there was no malice there. To call up a demon, you must learn its name. Men dreamed that once, but now it is real in another way. You know that, Case. Your business is to learn the names of programs, the long, formal names, names the owners seek to conceal, true names. A Turing code's not your name. Neuromancer, the boy said, slitting long gray eyes against the rising sun. The lane to the land of the dead, where you are, my friend. Marie France, my lady, she prepared this road, but her lord choked her off before I could read the book of her days. Neuro from the nerves, the silver paths. Romancer, necromancer, I call up the dead, but no, my friend. And the boy did a little dance, brown feet printing the sand. I am the dead, and their land. He laughed. A gull cried. Stay. If your woman is a ghost, she doesn't know it. Neither will you. You're cracking. The ice is breaking up. No, he said, suddenly sad, his fragile shoulders sagging. He rubbed his foot against the sand. It is more simple than that, but the choice is yours. The gray eyes regarded Case gravely. A fresh wave of symbols swept across his vision, one line at a time. Behind them, the boy wriggled, as though seen through heat rising from summer asphalt. The music was loud now, and Case could almost make out the lyrics. Case, honey, Linda said, and touched his shoulder. No, he said. He took off his jacket and handed it to her. I don't know, he said. Maybe you're here. Anyway, it gets cold. He turned and walked away, and after the seventh step, he'd closed his eyes, watching the music define itself at the center of things. He did look back once, although he didn't open his eyes. He didn't need to. They were there by the edge of the sea, Linda Lee and the thin child who said his name was Neuromancer. His leather jacket dangled from her hand, catching the fringe of the surf. He walked on, following the music. Malcolm's Zion Dub. There was a gray place, an impression of fine screens shifting, moire, degrees of half-tone generated by a very simple graphics program. There was a long hold on a view through chain link, gulls frozen above dark water. There were voices. There was a plane of black mirror that tilted, and he was quicksilver, a bead of mercury skittering down, striking the angles of an invisible maze, fragmenting, flowing together, sliding again. Case, Mon? The music. You back, Mon? The music was taken from his ears. How long? He heard himself ask, and knew that his mouth was very dry. 5 minute, maybe. Too long. I want pull the jack. Mute say no. Screen going funny, then mute say put the phones on you. He opened his eyes. Malcolm's features were overlaid with bands of translucent hieroglyphs. And you medicine, Malcolm said. Two derm. He was flat on his back on the library floor below the monitor. The Zionite helped him sit up, but the movement threw him into the savage rush of the beta-phenethylamine, the blue derms burning against his left wrist. Overdose, he managed. Come on, Mon, the strong hands beneath his armpits lifting him like a child. I must go. Chapter 22. The service cart was crying. The beta-phenethylamine gave it a voice. It wouldn't stop. Not in the crowded gallery, the long corridors, not as it passed the black glass entrance to the TA crypt, the vaults where the cold had seeped so gradually into old Ashpool's dreams. The transit was an extended rush for Case, the movement of the cart indistinguishable from the insane momentum of the overdose. When the cart died at last, something beneath the seat giving up with a shower of white sparks, the crying stopped. The thing coasted to a stop 3 meters from the start of Three Jane's Pirate Cave. How far, Mon? Malcolm helped him from the sputtering cart as an integral extinguisher exploded in the thing's engine compartment, gouts of yellow powder squirting from louvers and service points. The brawn tumbled from the back of the seat and hobbled off the imitation sand, dragging one useless limb behind it. You must walk, Mon. Malcolm took the deck and construct, slinging the shock cords over his shoulder. The trodes rattled around Case's neck as he followed the Zionite. Riviera's hollows waited for them, the torture scenes and the cannibal children. Molly had broken the triptych. Malcolm ignored them. Easy, Case said, forcing himself to catch up with the striding figure. Gotta do this right. Malcolm halted, turned, glowering at him, the Remington in his hands. Right, Mon. How's right? Got Molly in there, but she's out of it. Riviera, he can throw hollows. Maybe he's got Molly's Fletcher. Malcolm nodded. And there's a ninja, a family bodyguard. Malcolm's frown deepened. You listen, Babylon Mon, he said. I a warrior, but this no my fight. No Zion fight. Babylon fighting Babylon, eating itself, you know. But Jah say I an had to bring Steppin' Razor out of this. Case blinked. She a warrior, Malcolm said, as if it explained everything. Now you tell me, Mon, who I not to kill? Three Jane, he said after a pause. A girl there, has a kind of white robe thing on, with a hood. We need her. When they reached the entrance, Malcolm walked straight in, and Case had no choice but to follow him. Three Jane's country was deserted, the pool empty. Malcolm handed him the deck and the construct and walked to the edge of the pool. Beyond the white pool furniture there was darkness, shadows of the ragged, waist-high maze of partially demolished walls. The water lapped patiently against the side of the pool. They're here, Case said. They gotta be. Malcolm nodded. The first arrow pierced his upper arm. The Remington roared, its meter of muzzle flash blue in the light from the pool. The second arrow struck the shotgun itself, sending it spinning across the white tiles. Malcolm sat down hard and fumbled at the black thing that protruded from his arm. He yanked at it. Hideo stepped out of the shadows, a third arrow ready in a slender bamboo bow. He bowed. Malcolm stared, his hand still on the steel shaft. The artery is intact, the ninja said. Case remembered Molly's description of the man who'd killed her lover. Hideo was another. Ageless, he radiated a sense of quiet and utter calm. He wore clean, frayed khaki work pants and soft, dark shoes that fit his feet like gloves, split at the toes like tabi socks. The bamboo bow was a museum piece, but the black alloy quiver that protruded above his left shoulder had the look of the best Chiba weapons shops. His brown chest was bare and smooth. You cut my thumb, Mon, with second one, Malcolm said. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.